Good morning. Can you hear me okay? I'd like to do, I move around a lot, so I'm going to do the conformity piece, and I'm standing up here, which I don't normally do, but hopefully this will tether me, and this should still work okay. You guys excited to talk about Judges? It's a very exciting book of the Bible. I was going to ask you to raise your hands to see who's read it, but I'm not going to put anybody on the spot. If you haven't read Judges, hopefully going through this very briefly this morning will give you a really good perspective on how to approach the book of Judges, or if it's, even if it's just been a while, hopefully you'll find this very helpful. Of course, I've been reading some books in my preparation, but I've also been listening to some sermons, and an interesting thing I noted was about half of them are evening sermons. Like, they've been demoted to the evening, basically. So I don't know if that's, this isn't snappy, inspirational, or catchy enough to deserve a Sunday morning, or maybe in all fairness, it's an age-appropriate thing because it's pretty wild stuff. So anyway, I found that quite fascinating. As children, we learn about judges through the stories of these people, Gideon, Deborah, Samson, and so on, people that God raised up to accomplish amazing feats. Some find them fantastical, but of course, if you believe in a God who created the universe, these are pretty small accomplishments, actually. And the deliverers do amazing things. As adults, we tend to better understand it in the course of history, that these are real events that took place in the ancient Near East over 1,000 years before the coming of the Messiah. And the history that's recorded is, of course, often a bloody one at that. While both of these are certainly true, I think that what we'll see first and foremost in our overview today, what stands out the most and best encapsulates Judges is understanding it as a tragedy. The lens through which we're going to read the book is tragedy specifically due to compromise. The recurring theme of the stories as they take place, I'm just going to hold this, as we go throughout the book, is inside the historical context, we see Israel's cycle of unfaithfulness and sin, followed by God's judgment, seen in oppression by their enemies. And then at last, of course, Israel cries out and pleads to Yahweh for relief. And then this leads to God's gracious deliverance of his people, after which they usually enjoy a considerable time of peace, but only for a time. And then they are tempted again. What's worse, though, because it does get worse, we'll see also that whenever this pattern occurs, Israel actually ends up considerably worse off each time. They are diminished after every cycle. So when you compare what happens at the end of Joshua, which is basically where Judges starts to the end of the book, it is hard to imagine how things could get much worse. There are 7 cycles of failure, bondage, despair, and rescue. And like I said, that would be bad enough. But since they become less recognizable as Israel, the problem is even their leaders become unaware of the God that they're supposed to be worshiping and serving. But beyond that, there's still a larger overarching narrative that we've been alluding to behind all the stories, which is for the reader to see in action God's patience, his long-suffering, his justice, his omniscience, his power, and that he never once fails on any of his promises, ever. Just a few background notes on the author and the setting and how this ties into the surrounding books. Judges records what's called an intermediate period in Israel's history. So this is a time of tremendous disunity between the time of unity that was what we saw at the close of Joshua and the time before the unifying influence that came with the kings later on under Samuel, who is probably the author. A few reasons for these are the account of Samuel's birth actually takes place immediately after the period of Judges. As I think Wendell mentioned the other day, the book of Ruth, which is next in our Bibles, actually took place during the time of Judges. Actually, the first words in the book of Ruth are during the time when the judges ruled Israel. And some think Ruth may have actually been originally part of Judges. Secondly, rather than a dry sort of facts-only approach, there is a, once you get past the first chapter, there's an unmistakable moral and theological tone to the book that is how you would expect a prophet to write a book. Thirdly, the accounts in Judges are very widespread geographically among the different tribes. The unification that came later with the kings probably would have been the first time that all these stories could have been gathered together into one place and consolidate the accounts, which would have been overseen by Samuel. And then fourthly, the phrase that we'll see later, in those days Israel had no king, obviously implies it, this was written after the time of the first king, which would be Saul. If Ruth is part of Judges, then it, because of her genealogy, it would have been during the time of David, and then there's other historical information that leads us to believe it must have been probably written before the time of Solomon, which would be Samuel's time. So it's pretty conclusive evidence. How Judges fits in chronologically on our series is actually very straightforward. It picks up, as I said, things from the end of Joshua, which Steve laid out for us last week, and that's the context of walking into Judges. We have a pretty seamless transition. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the end of Joshua, some of 23 and some of 24. You can follow along if you want, but I'm going to kind of skip through the accounts, so it might be just as well to listen. That's up to you. And then, by the way, when we get into Judges, if you actually have a paper Bible, we'll be kind of flying through it pretty quickly and just hitting some passages hit or miss, so you might find that easier to use than your phone, but that's up to you. Or you can just listen. So yeah, going back to Joshua 23, verse 1, a long time had passed, and the Lord had given Israel rest from all their enemies around them. So they're doing well at this point. And Joshua is now a very old man, and he summons all Israel, their elders, their leaders, judges, and officials, and he tells them of God's promise concerning the Canaanites that still remain. So as Steve said, there's still some Canaanites left in the land, and they are there specifically to test who will be left after Joshua. Verse 5, the Lord your God himself will push them out for your sake. He will drive them out before you, and you will take possession of the land as the Lord your God had promised you. But it's conditional. Be very strong, though. Be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the left or the right. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the name of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but hold fast to the Lord your God as you have until now. And they reply, the people of Israel reply in chapter 24, far be it from us to forsake the Lord and serve other gods. And they promise, we too will serve the Lord, for he is our God. But Joshua is not so sure. He says, you are not able to serve the Lord. He's a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your rebellion and your sins if you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods. He will turn and bring you disaster and make an end of you after he's been good to you. But people reply, nope, we will serve the Lord. So Joshua says, all right, you are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen to serve the Lord, and he sends them away. And that's how the book ends. Leads us directly into Judges 1:1. It could have just been tagged right on the end. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who of us will go up first to fight against the Canaanites, right, to claim the rest of the land? So that should all make perfect sense. Well, before we proceed into the book, we actually have a small issue to deal with here concerning the order of the book and how things start out, and you'll see what I mean here in a second. Chapter 1 basically is an extremely compact narrative of the accounts of the war campaigns right after Joshua's death, and they start out very hopeful, but as the account proceeds, things fall apart, and they fall apart very quickly. The emphasis becomes increasingly on the campaigns that failed, and many of them were never attempted in the first place. And so Judah and the other tribes do not end up keeping their promise, which brings us to the beginning of chapter 2, where an angel of the Lord comes to them to deliver judgment on Israel, and that God will no longer drive out the people before him, just as he had sworn he wouldn't if they were disobedient. Upon hearing this, of course, the Israelites weep and offer sacrifices to the Lord in their great distress. But then the account ends abruptly, and we read in chapter 2, verse 6, after Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to their own inheritance. And even as I was, for the first time rereading, I hadn't read Judges in a while, admittedly, and I was going back through it, and I'm like, why is he alive again all of a sudden? Because he just died not too long ago. So this is pretty confusing. So we have to stop and ask questions. If you're studying your Bible, you don't just plow through and be like, oh well, that's not good, right? Because you're missing something if you do that. So it appears maybe, okay, is this repetitive? Is this actually an error? What happened here? Well, it makes great sense if we understand the structure of the book and why it's there. The author has laid out in summary form that Israel's conquest and future plans did not at all play out as we had hoped that the end of Joshua would have implied that it would have. So this sets the tone for the rest of the book, and it leaves the reader with a whole list of unanswered questions, like how could this all go on so poorly, so quickly? After all, they were somewhat obedient, even though they didn't take over the whole land. And by the way, where was God in all this? And this is the background for understanding the next and largest section of the book, which is the period of Israel's history, where the Lord raised up judges to deliver his people. Israel, of course, needed leadership and divine intervention. And in verse 6, the author is basically resetting his narrative to expand on what happened now that we already know how things turned out. So he's got the sort of the spoiler alert, this is what happens, and now he's going to go back and expand on why that is the case. So as I learned from Steve last week, when outlining a large amount of material, like Judges, I'm expected to have a short, snappy outline of some kind. So here we go. What the author is doing for us in up till chapter 2, verse 5, is he is framing the book. Okay? And then when we get to the end of the book, I don't know if you guys remember this, but there's these two terrible stories. So, and then we have in the intermediate section, we have the judges. So I'm apparently not made for modern, that's not a word. I don't know if you noticed that. I was gonna put intermediate judges, but it felt like too much of a stretch. So I'm gonna ditch the outline and we're just gonna go with this picture right here, which is actually very easy to understand. Once the author frames the book, of course the book is largely about the judges, and then the follow-up stories are very interesting, and we'll get to those in just a minute. So this should be very easy to remember. So with this simple outline, we'll get into the text a bit. Of course, we can only just drill down in a few places, given our time. But I've picked examples that I think help illustrate the main point I'd like to make about Judges, which is, kind of like I've said, knowing that the author is tracking Israel's consistent spiritual deterioration really helps our understanding of the book because it gives us an informed perspective to read Judges by and to better understand why the author selected the details that he chose to select and record. Why that information or why those details or why did she say that? What is going on there? Of course, these are similar to questions we should be asking of all scripture that we read. Of course, much of the information regarding Judges and the battles are just facts, so I'm not suggesting that the information has been manipulated, but anytime somebody compiles information, they pick and choose the details they want to talk about, which is very normal, and the author is choosing the details that tell us the bigger picture that is going on aside from the history. So it makes sense he would choose historical details that give us insight and contribute to the bigger picture. You might think of it as reading Judges in a critical, sort of almost suspicious fashion. The author, this is my fancy little picture here, he's sort of cast this shadow, or he's cast a pall over the book, and it's like, okay, here's what happens, here's why everything is so terrible. So we wouldn't be wrong to sort of lead it in that light. Now, this doesn't distort our view of the book, it actually helps clarify exactly what it is we're reading about. It helps. Rather than obscuring it. That's what it does for us. Having said that, we obviously can't go through the book and assume there's something pejorative or hidden behind every statement that is said. We have to have good reason, but it does give us a way to appreciate the book in a fuller way, and I think given the examples I have, this will make great sense. So they asked the Lord, who of us will go up to fight first? Sort of back to, sorry, wrong slide. We'll get back to that. Who of us will go to fight first? And the Lord answers. So again, with this filter, this makes so much more sense. Almost everything in the book makes more sense. Who of us will go up? The Lord says, Judah shall go up. I've given the land into their hands. Then the men of Judah then said to the Simeonites, their fellow Israelites, come up with us to our territory allotted and fight against the Canaanites, and in turn we will go fight your enemies. Why is this detail recorded? That's the question that we have to keep on asking. While Judah does act, they do not do it in the way that God directed. And this is the theme we see throughout the entire book. they will sometimes do things, but not in the right way. Verse 4, they attack and defeat 10,000 of the Canaanites and the Perizzites at Bezek. And when they take their king, Adonai Bezek, they don't kill him like they were told. What do they do instead? They did to him what he did to 70 other kings. Remember, he repaid him by cutting off his thumbs and his toes. They're basically sort of hamstringing him and humiliating him now that they're in charge. But the Lord remains with them for a time. And there are several successful campaigns that continue until we read in verse 19, the Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive out the people from the plains because they had chariots fitted with iron. Now, unable is a bit misleading there because it seems Judah is ineffective simply due to being intimidated. The way the New Living Translation says, it says they failed to drive out the people. And we already know from chapter 2 that God judged them for failing to take him up on his promises, and he wouldn't have done this if this was impossible. We also read, actually later in chapter 4, that under Deborah they were able to defeat this army. As I said, the emphasis in chapter 1 focuses on all of these failed campaigns. The Benjamites did not drive out the Jebusites. Manasseh did not, for the Canaanites were determined to live in the land. Now, so there's difficulties, right? But then it says, when Israel became strong enough to overcome them, they what? They pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out. They thought they could make a profit off of this and that it would not, that nothing bad would come from it. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites. They continued to live among them. Neither did Zebulun, it goes on, nor did Asher, neither did Naphtali. And it gets worse. The Amorites confined the Danites. So not only are they like, well, we're not really going to push them out. Now they're finally at last, of course, turning against them. They did not allow them to come down into the plain. So Israel's failure to drive them out left basically what amounts to a cancer in their midst. Because of this, generations of God's people were brought up under false gods, excessive sin, fear, ongoing war, death, and were ultimately disciplined by God and enslaved and oppressed by the very enemies that they were supposed to overpower and conquer. So that's fun. The judges with perspective. Okay, so going through the judges this is great stuff. In his great patience, because God was moved by their cries, it pleased the Lord to give the tribes of Israel opportunities for redemption. So it starts in, I'm going to just start reading in chapter 2, verse 16. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them from the hands of their raiders. So this is where the reader might start to have some hope again. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and he saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived, for the Lord relented because of their groaning under those who had oppressed and afflicted them. But what happens when the judge dies? The people return to ways even more corrupt than those of their ancestors, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused, I'm quoting, to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways. So to be clear, God is not being petty. The worship of Baal and Ashtaroth, as I'm sure many of you know, involved ritualistic temple prostitution, and at times, human sacrifice. So, I do believe I remember Steve mentioning this last week. God is so patient. He waited until their sin had reached its full fruition, and he stayed off judgment until then. And in this case, again, we have child sacrifice and things that are, of course, unspeakable. And the amazing thing is the Israelites wanted to be just like them. The reader knows before we even read about the first judge, based on what I just read, before we get into the first judge, that these opportunities for redemption were not taken. And we know this before we go into the accounts. So looking for clues in the text that support this would be completely warranted. This graphic of the timeline of the judges, sort of going horizontally like a typical timeline, shows where they fit in chronologically. As Wendell mentioned a couple weeks ago, the stories of the judges often take place simultaneously in the different regions. If you took all the judges of the reigns of the judges back to back, you'd have something like over 400 years, but we know it was closer to a little over 300 years. And since they're in different areas, this makes good sense. The colors then are stacked vertically, demonstrating the deteriorating integrity or spiritual character of the judges, which we'll talk more about as we go. The judges are, for the most part, recorded in chronological order, but not quite. So the author prioritizes arranging the judges with respect to Israel's decline, which is his bigger focus, even over the history, with the historical counts basically serving as the framework. So this is obviously a good place to pause and ask, what is a judge exactly? If you're familiar with any of the Old Testament accounts, or you've read them, you already know that the word judge isn't how we use it today, right? So I'm picturing like an Allen County court judge doing jury selection and then going out and leading a campaign to expand our borders into Ohio. They don't do that. That's not their thing, right? That's not their place. Judges are typically military leaders, but it's probably more accurate to think of them more broadly as tribal leaders, since they're not always at war. And we see some judges also involved in other affairs of the people. Like Deborah, for example, was called a judge, and that she held court, and she was also a prophetess. And when the time of battle came, she asked for the help of Barak to lead the troops. Okay, so kind of going through these in the groups that are suggested in the text, the first group of judges aren't far removed from Joshua's influence, so we run into the least amount of questionable activity on Israel's part, which is nice. But even at this stage, an honest look at judges does require removing the kid-friendly filter, which is great because the kids are in Sunday school. The first judge is Othniel, and you may remember that's Caleb's nephew, and it's also his son-in-law. At the beginning of the account, we see the familiar words. You probably recall these. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. This is always the start of the cycle, the way the author records it. This brings about God's wrath. They're taken captive. They cry out for help. And he raises up a rescuer, in this case, Othniel, to save them. The Lord gave them victory, and they enjoyed peace for 40 years. And then by the time we get to verse 12, the people again of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the cycle just keeps going. This time God raised up Ehud. He's a left-handed man from the tribe of Benjamin. Remember, he's the one that thrust the dagger in the belly of Eglon and the fat closed in around it. Really weird story. Killed a lot of Moabites, and they had peace for 80 years. So it was good for them. No particular circumstances surround raising up of the next judge, Shamgar. He's the first judge that would be considered a minor judge because not much is written about him, kind of like the same distinction we have between the major and the minor prophets. Quite a lot is written about Deborah in chapters 4 and 5, and chapter 5 is where we find Deborah's song. It's a poem, so we have to read it as such, and this is where we find more signs of trouble brewing. This is lots of foreshadowing in this book, which is very helpful. When Israel chose new gods, this is chapter 5, verse 8. When Israel chose new gods, war erupted at the city gates, which could be a good thing. The people of the Lord marched down against the mighty warriors. They came down from Ephraim. They followed you, Benjamin, with your troops from Machir, which is in Manasseh. The commanders marched down from Zebulun, came those to carry the commander's staff. The princes of Issachar were with Deborah and Barak. But in the tribe of Reuben, there was great indecision. Gilead remained east in the Jordan. And why did Dan stay home? Not Dan Saracen, Dan the tribe. Asher sat unmoved at the seashore. But Zebulun risked his life, as did Naphtali. So you've already got a serious division forming within Israel, which is actually even the bigger problem than not overcoming their enemies, as we'll see later. In the next group of judges, we have Gideon, Tola, and Jair. As we reach the second group here, things do get a little dicier. In this group, Gideon is the only major judge, and there's quite a bit of material on his life, covers chapters 6 through 9. The Midianites had so oppressed Israel that at this point they were all hiding out in caves, at least the tribe of Manasseh, which Gideon was part of. They were hiding in the mountains and in the caves, which is why when the angel of the Lord comes to him, and this is all, there's so many details in Judges, it's a little overwhelming. It says Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press, which doesn't make any sense. But if you know he's hiding out and he's a little cowardly, that makes a lot of sense because he wants to keep it from the Midianites. And the angel said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Go with the strength you have and rescue Israel from the Midianites. I'm sending you out." But Gideon asked for a sign. This is not the fleece yet. He asked for a sign, which the Lord gives him. He brings an offering to the angel of the Lord, puts it in front of him. He consumes it with his staff, and then the angel himself disappears. And of course, he thinks he's going to die because he's seen an angel of the Lord. He doesn't, because he came there to tell him to go do something. But he's convinced. He is sold. Absolutely, it's certain. So sure enough, an enemy alliance crosses the Jordan to attack the tribe, and Gideon summons three other tribes to help him. And this is where Gideon does his famous fleece test on the threshing floor. So I'm going to say it, even though I shouldn't have to say it. I'd like to think we're all fully aware that laying fleeces out before the Lord is not a model being promoted in this account. Even as he does it, Gideon's actually pretty bashful about it and apologetic to the Lord, like he's going to strike him down any second for being so cowardly. And it's one of the many things the author records that really doesn't cast Gideon in a very positive light. But of course, the Lord is patient with him, and he works with him anyway, because even in his fear and his trepidation, he is willing to be obedient, which is probably why he's in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11. Interestingly, in chapter 7, there is something specifically prescribed by the Lord that I don't think anyone's ever used again. Do you remember? He thins out his troops by sending them down to the stream, and based on how they drink water out of their hands or lap it up like a dog, that's how he whittles down the army. But I'm not sure anyone's ever used that. But it was specifically God's idea. So maybe we should do that. I don't know. In any case, Gideon and his small army of trumpets and jars, they win the day, they drive out the Midianites. But, and this is important later, the Ephraimites, fellow Jews, remember, they're offended because they weren't included in the battle. Gideon doesn't say, well, the Lord told me to do this. He appeals to their vanity and says, well, you're bigger and stronger. You got it made. Don't be jealous of me. He staves them off, and he stays, and it's like, it's fine, nothing happens, but you're going to see later that this plays out very differently under another judge. But they're able to still, as Israel, hold it together a little bit. Oddly enough, after Gideon plays ambassador, he and his army is still chasing down the Midianites with his little band of brothers there, and he ends up murdering the men of Succoth for not giving his troops bread and water. So Gideon goes from being really cowardly and sheepish, and now he's a little out of control. And he stays out of control for the rest of his life, as far as we can tell. When they're victorious, the Israelites ask him to rule over them. He says he doesn't want to, and he claims he wants to establish the theocracy in Israel where the Lord rules over them. But he still wants to act like a king. He asks for their gold. He makes idols so that they can bow down and worship him. Worship them. He marries many women. He has 70 sons. And this is where Abimelech comes in, who's just a complete scourge on Israel. And it's that whole story is awful, and we don't have time to cover that. But it's so interesting because, like, you think of idol worship. I mean, it's the second commandment. It's not an obscure thing. But you never hear about the law being brought up in Judges once. Just a few stories handed down from their forefathers about how the Lord rescued them from Egypt. But that's about it. And that's what happens when we step away from the word. Of the next two judges, Tola and Jair, little said about them except they rose up to save Israel for a time, which does lead us to our third group. Jephthah, super interesting character. Again, the Israelites, chapter 10, this would be right, verse 1. I didn't write that down. I think that's right. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. So God gives them over to the Philistines and the Ammonites for 18 years, pretty long this time. They cry out for help, but this time the Lord replies when the Egyptians and the Amorites and the Ammonites and the Philistines and the Sidonians, and he goes on for a bit, when you cried out to me about those guys, did I not save you from their hands? But you've forsaken me and served other gods, so call out to them, let them save you. But the Israelites said to the Lord, we have sinned. And this is really the first and only time you see anything resembling true repentance in the book. Do with us whatever you think best, but please rescue us now. And most importantly, then they got rid of the foreign gods among them and served the Lord. So you might think the book's on an upswing. That does not last long, but it is probably the highlight of the whole book there in chapter 10. So we have a glimmer of hope. It is not, sadly, to last very long. Sorry, that was chapter 11, I guess. Chapter 11 is the story of Jephthah, a mighty warrior who's also the son of a prostitute. So he is rejected by his family, basically, and he goes to live in the hill, and he's a leader of a bunch of thugs, basically. And when the Ammonites attack, the elders of Gilead go to him, and all of a sudden, they want to be his friend. They want his help. And so Jephthah is, of course, a little put out, and he says, well, I'll help as long as you install me as leader after the fact. So they agree, and he goes out to war against the Ammonites. And this is where, in chapter 11, Jephthah made a vow to the Lord, that you may remember. If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes... Why would you say this? Whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph will be the Lord's, and I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. So he is a rash man. If you know the rest of the story, it's his only daughter, still unmarried, that comes out to greet him when he gets home. And in his grief, he has the nerve to say, you have brought me down, and I am devastated. So he's clueless also, apparently. I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break. And this is so fascinating. He has this form of religiosity and some sense of morals, but it is so twisted beyond recognition, he is somehow godless at the same time. So why did he do this? And I've asked this question myself as I go through many of these stories. How in the world does this make any sense? Was he just drunk when he said it? Like, what could possibly be the reason? But if we think about the long-term influence of the depraved culture around him that Israel chose to put up with, rash acts of child sacrifice that could be possible now fit their worldview and way of thinking. It actually made some sense to him. Not that he knew that it would be his daughter necessarily, but he certainly knew it was a possibility. But this is so foreign to the idea of Yahweh that at first when we read it, we're like, what is going on here? But this is not the God that Jephthah has in mind in the least. He and his fellow Israelites have been so steeped in this, he doesn't know the God of Israel anymore. One more thing about Jephthah, that he is the one that also has an encounter with the Ephraimites. Remember that Gideon appeased them by appealing to their vanity. Didn't go so well this time. Now they're upset because he went out to fight the Ammonites without them, and this time there is a... short civil war where 42,000 Jews fell in battle because they couldn't resolve their dispute. So as you can see, things are getting much worse. And they continue. Samson, the last judge mentioned, chapters 13 through 16, quite a bit of material on him. He's born as a dedicated Nazarite for his entire life. Number 6 tells us this means that such a person must abstain from any wine or fermented drink, never cut his or her hair for the length of the vow, and never go near a dead body because that would make them ceremonially unclean. Well, Samson is portrayed as brave and bold and strong from the very beginning. Many have noted the stark contrast between Gideon, who didn't think he could basically do anything, and Samson, who thought he had everything to offer. In today's terms, Samson would be a good candidate for several different diagnoses. He's in a rage all the time, and he thinks he is invincible, which is partially true of his physical strength and prowess. Of all the amazing stories about him, remember we have like the riddle of the lion and the wedding clothes. That's fascinating. All the foxes he catches to set his enemies' crops on fire. I think that is the biggest miracle in Judges. I don't even know how you find 300 foxes. Like, where would they come from? That's amazing. Nope, I don't know. He carries away the city gates on his shoulders, and then he kills hundreds of men with a fresh donkey's jawbone. I'm sure that's a pretty famous story. But we tend to associate him most with Delilah, right? And there's good reason. We tend to think of her as his downfall. After all, he seems nearly indestructible, and she's the nagging woman who defeated him. But that's not true. His real downfall was not taking his vow to the Lord seriously. Why did Samson tell Delilah about his hair that fourth time around? I mean, I know she's nagging him and says his soul was vexed to death, which is, that's pretty powerful. But it's still a little hard to believe. But again, think about, what do we see in his life? Every other part of the Nazarite vow, he had already broken up to this point, one at a time. He drank wine, he took the honey from the lion's carcass just for a snack, just on a whim, and then made a joke out of it by making a riddle. And then some. He slept with prostitutes. He's, frankly, a pretty godless man. So it's not really a stretch to think that when Delilah, again, is killing him with words, He probably was able to rationalize it. What's one more broken vow? What's one more sin? I'm still strong. The other things I did didn't seem to make any difference. But this time he was wrong. In the end, the Lord was still able to use a man like Samson, which is the amazing part. Now, captured by the Philistines, of course, eyes gouged out, and a slave, he's finally humbled. He bows before the Lord and defeats the Philistine leaders, but only by dying the same gruesome death. So, after all the accounts of the judges, you would think that would be the end, but there are two stories, and there's a very good point to having them in the book. One of them is just plain weird, and the last one is extremely disturbing. What they do is they each serve to illustrate how far Israel has fallen, basically to say there's consequences and fallout from everything that happened since the time of Joshua, and how all these wicked influences were allowed to continue. The phrase that's repeatedly used in these four chapters to summarize all the fallout from the first 16 chapters is the phrase, "In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what is right, what was right in his own eyes." Relativism, basically. The first story, in brief, is very brief, is of, because it's so weird, is of an Israelite named Micah, not the prophet, by the way, much earlier than that. And his mother curses him for stealing her silver, then blesses him for returning it. Very superstitious people. Then they make an ephod out of it. Remember, now this is a established practice from Gideon, so they probably thought this was the right thing to do. Who knows? And in a twisted kind of syncretistic form of Judaism, he even installs one of his sons as a priest. I guess you can just do that. So Hayden can be my priest. I don't know. I don't know. It's just so bizarre. Then a Levite comes along and Micah pays him to stay with him and becomes his priest, thinking this, because he's a Levite, this gives me some more legitimacy, right? He's so clueless, he says, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me since this Levite has become my priest." At this time, the Danites are sort of out looking for a new home, and in short, they ran off with Micah's expensive apron and the Levite. Then they were under the same impression, God must be with us because we got these things. So it was just like anything goes all the time. So what happened is then Dan, the tribe of Dan, attacked the people at Laish, seemingly without provocation. It was not part of the Lord's command. And they settled there and continued to worship this idol of silver. And then the story just stops. That's it. But what's interesting is if you get into 1 Chronicles, in chapters 3 through 9, all the tribes of Israel are mentioned after the Assyrian conquest, except Dan. They basically, around 720 BC, disappeared from history forever. All right, and the last story, which is crazy. If you've read it, I'd encourage you to read it. It's very sobering. In the last and by far the worst account in chapters 19 to 21, which starts out, "In those days Israel had no king," of course, same line. A different Levite lived in a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim. He took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah, but she was unfaithful to him, so she left and went back to her parents' home. So he gets an extra wife, she's unfaithful, goes home, he chases after her, and then the father-in-law is happy to see him when he shows up. I mean, everything is very strange and weird at this time. He finally ends up taking her home and has to stop along the way because it's a very long journey. And he, interestingly, avoids staying at a non-Israelite town, that of the Jebusites, and he stays at Gibeah, which is a Benjamite town, thinking he's probably safe, but he's not. No one takes him in for the night, which speaks very poorly of the community. As we've talked about, hospitality was a very big deal back then. No one takes him in except an old man, an Ephraimite, comes down from the hills, comes down from the fields at the end of the day and sees them there and warns them, do not spend the night in the square, and welcomes them into his home. And that evening, a gang of men from the town come and want to have sex with the man that he's harboring. That's just what they do. They want. As he's taken them into his home, he's obligated to protect him and his life and everything he owns. The man refuses the men, which seems noble, but then he offers them his virgin daughter and the man's concubine. So the account of what happens to the concubine kind of makes Sodom and Gomorrah seem a little tame. Basically, she is abused and she dies. And even the reaction of the husband in the morning, he comes out, even the account of what he says is chilling. He's a little put out that this has happened. It's amazing. It's awful. When they reached home, he took a knife and cut up the concubine limb by limb into 12 parts and sent them out to the areas of Israel. Everyone who saw it said to one another, "Such a thing has never been seen or done since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt." So they're getting a bit of a wake-up call, and it's about time. Just imagine, we must do something. Speak up. That's how it ends, in reference to what the Benjamites did. In short, this culminates, and the way the book ends, is civil war among Israel, with many other odd twists and turns in the stories. Things have deteriorated to the point that in the end, the reader is basically left wondering if Israel is going to survive at all. It's no coincidence the last books, the last words in Judges are, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Things are at an all-time low by the end of the book, and it is completely unresolved and unsettling, and that's how it ends. So I hope you are all inspired. That is amazing. I'm sorry, but it's interesting to think if Ruth had been the original ending to the book as a third story, you might say, this would have given the reader hope and foreshadow what's to come, the promised Messiah. It certainly would have been appropriate to do that, but it also would have taken away from the urgency and the general convicting and awfulness of the book. So what about applications? Well, I kind of think if you have to point out the applications, you might not have been paying attention. The most surface applications, of course, we can't help but see. I mean, things like do not be deceived, bad company corrupts good character, do not be yoked together with unbelievers, what fellowship can light have with darkness? Those are certainly clear. After all, we live in a culture now. If we think of our own example, which is not the point of the book, but if we were to think of our own example in our culture, not even the extreme things that we see, like transsexual policies and abortion, but even divorce, and even things that have become common, like believers living together as an example before they're being married. Not that long ago in our culture, that would have been largely frowned upon. And so things do change in a culture. Certainly, the inevitable effects of compromise, faithlessness, and sin are much worse than we can ever imagine. That is a clear takeaway from the book. But that would still come short of the author's main intention, aside from recording the history that took place. The author was quite successful in showing that Israel, who's God's chosen people, failed to do what they had promised to do through compromise after compromise and lack of faith, while God never failed to do what he said he would do. He said he would bless his people if they obeyed, and he said he would punish them if they didn't. Not only because he's just, but because he cares about them. Ultimately, Judges is the story of God's good and unchanging nature. The promises he made to Israel through Joshua he kept, but of course he also kept the promises he made to Abraham, specifically that his seed would ultimately save mankind and come through his descendants. So I thought it would be good to close. I've been thinking of songs we could sing that tie into the Old Testament series we've been doing, and the song we'll sing this morning as the musicians come up is O God, Our Help in Ages Past, which seems fitting. So please stand.